Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Yeah, the fleet has been grounded. At some airlines, that's a small percentage of their total fleet. At other airlines, it's a larger percentage. So the effect on any individual airline is more or less proportional to the extent to which that airplane is significant in their fleets.
That's aviation expert Robert Mann Jr. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, the Trump administration intensifies measures to curb the flow of Central American migrants crossing into the U.S. from Mexico. And a White House staffer tells investigators senior Trump officials approved security badges for at least 25 people despite an array of concerns. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a whistleblower from inside the White House has told U.S. congressional investigators that senior Trump administration officials granted national security clearances to at least 25 people that government reviewers had rejected for an array of concerns. The whistleblower, Tricia Newbold, said the officials cleared for security credentials after career employees recommended they be denied. Include two current unnamed senior White House officials, government contractors, and other staff aides working for the office of President Donald Trump. For more insight into this story, joining me live here in the studio is VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Kim.
Well, Steve, why did this whistleblower have these concerns?
She said that if she didn't come forward, she would be doing a disservice to her country and her family if she sat back knowing that the issues that could have an impact of national security weren't revealed. It's a bit of an unusual situation with someone who is still in this administration coming forward in such a manner.
Also, is this something new or unprecedented, or because, first of all, it involves so many people, 25 people, and also because of the circumstances, and some of these people are family members?
Correct. It is believed that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is one of the 25 applicants who the people in the security office were overruled about his clearance, and that he was given a clearance. And it's unusual to the degree that a congressional committee, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, is meeting today to discuss a subpoena for the man who was the personnel security director during the first 2 years of the Trump presidency.
Also, can you tell us a little bit more about the actual whistleblower and her role there at the White House?
Yes, Kim. Her name is Tricia Newbold, and she's been in this position for 18 years, and she's been there through Republican presidents and Democratic Party presidents. And she is considered somebody who is a real straight shooter, no nonsense, and very devoted to her job in making sure that anyone who had something in their background would be flagged and not be given a security clearance in any administration.
So basically, she's just looking at what's in front of her, not really being political.
Correct. And the allegation here is that she is being overruled for political reasons.
Now, she does have the support of Congressman Elijah Cummings, who so really, what can Congress do at this point?
Well, Congress can hold hearings, subpoena people, have them testify under oath, and try to get to the bottom of it to see if there were legitimate reasons for giving these people clearances, even if the people working in the office said that they should not have clearances. But the bottom line, Kim, is the president can ultimately decide who gets a security clearance. Now, it's unclear at this point, and the president has said he did not intervene in these cases, but there is some suspicion, as you might imagine, that perhaps the president himself was involved in this.
And as you said, since he can overrule this, is there still an ethical issue involved?
Well, as we have seen in this administration, there have been numerous ethical issues. But in the eyes of many, ethics is a sort of a subjective category. And the question really is were any laws violated.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Kim.
Thank you. That's VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joining me here in the studio. Well, the Trump administration is intensifying measures to curb the flow of Central American asylum seekers crossing into the U.S. from Mexico, including sending more people back to Mexico to wait for their asylum claims to be heard by U.S. courts. U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to close the border if Mexico does not stop a surge of people, often traveling as families from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. The administration also says the president is also considering cutting off millions of dollars in aid to those three countries. Well, International Edition's Lori London spoke with Adam Eikenson, co-manager of the Border Security Program with the Washington Office for Latin America, about the potential impact of closing the border.
I imagine that he means closing down all the ports of entry. There are 45 land crossings, official land crossings across the border, and just stopping all traffic. Whether that would mean pedestrian and commercial traffic, we don't know, but assume it's everything. You would strand people on one side of the border. You would have inventories, including agricultural inventories, go rotten. You would cost billions of dollars in lost investment. You would see prices of many goods immediately rise on the United States side of the border. You would, however, not see any significant decrease in the number of Central American kids and families who cross the border and stand on U.S. soil and wait to be apprehended so that they can then ask for asylum. It's very easy to wade across the Rio Grande in El Paso where it's narrow. It's very easy to climb over the fence in San Diego and just wait for Border Patrol to come, as many are doing. And for those folks, it won't matter whether the ports of entry are open or not. That seems to be what has the president so angry, is these Central American kids and families, and closing the ports of entry is irrelevant.
Is it true that we do have a crisis?
It is definitely a crisis. If you add it up, by the end of this year, at least 1% of the entire population of Guatemala and Honduras will have been apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's pretty staggering, but it is a humanitarian crisis. A crisis of people suffering and so desperate that they're willing to uproot themselves and come here in massive numbers. It is not a border security crisis. It doesn't really represent much of a threat to our national security. And it is something that is administratively manageable if we were to build up our ports of entry, have decent monitoring programs, alternatives to detention programs, and have more judges to try these cases more quickly.
Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is now calling for the migrants that come in to be sent back over the border to Mexico. Right. How would that work?
Since December, there's been a program that Homeland Security calls a migrant protection protocols, but everybody else calls Remain in Mexico, where some families who are asking for asylum are being sent back into Mexico. Central American families asking for asylum are being sent back to Mexico, where they have a date on which they will be allowed back into the United States just to attend their hearings. And then they'll have to go back into Mexico while their asylum cases are considered and tried. Mexico did not agree to this. They say it was a unilateral decision of the United States, but they're so far agreeing to accept some of the Central Americans. So far, this has only, Remain in Mexico has only been applied to something like 350 to 400 Central Americans. But what Secretary Nielsen announced Monday is their plan, at least, is to ramp it up to hundreds of people a day. Now, if that happens, this is hundreds of basically homeless Central Americans they're going to send back into Mexico, where they might not even have family ties, to await their trials. If it's hundreds per day, it'll overwhelm whatever shelter capacity there is on the Mexican side immediately. You're going to start seeing refugee camps. You're going to start seeing tent cities. If you have actually hundreds of people a day in towns like Ciudad Juarez or Nogales or Mexicali, there won't be any place to put those Central Americans while they wait for courts to get around to hearing their cases. And it's going to cause a humanitarian emergency, a more severe one than we're seeing.
What do you think about the president's threats to cut hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to the Central American nations where these migrants are coming from?
The president's threats to cut aid to Central America are completely counterproductive and nonsensical. The aid was mostly going not to the governments of Central America, which have problems administering the aid. It was going to non-governmental organizations. It was going to anti-crime programs. It was going to police and judicial reform efforts. And stopping those will simply worsen conditions in some of the very communities that are expelling migrants right now. So it's not clear who Trump is punishing here. The whole idea of a lot of this aid, which was increased in the last few years, was to improve conditions so that people, the push factors sending people out of Central America would eventually start to improve. It's a slow motion process. But without that assistance, without those investments, some neighborhoods and some villages that would send a lot of migrants out but aren't now because they were getting assistance, they're going to start sending a lot of migrants out.
That was Adam Isaacson, co-manager of the Border Security Program with the Washington Office for Latin America, speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Well, President Donald Trump is meeting today with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House as the alliance prepares to celebrate its 70th anniversary. On April 4th, NATO members gathered in Washington will mark the 70th anniversary of the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty, part of a successful effort to contain Soviet expansionism and to cajole the war-torn nations of Western Europe to forsake ancient enmities and forge solidarity. But for the transatlantic alliance to continue, Europe will have to make a greater contribution and share more of the burden, some analysts warn. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO appeared uncertain about its role. But the return of Russian assertiveness under President Vladimir Putin has partly changed that. The alliance's supporters say NATO's traditional role of collective security has never been more important. Nonetheless, the U.S.-European alliance has been shaken by President Donald Trump's questioning of the very value of the transatlantic pact and periodically bruising encounters with EU leaders. Among the top stories in the world, more than a week after declaring victory over Islamic State's self-declared caliphate, U.S.-backed forces are still trying to clear the terror group's last stronghold of its fighters. A UN report says climate change, conflict, and economic instability created acute food insecurity for more than 113 million people around the globe last year. And 2 weeks after Cyclone Idai slammed into Mozambique, some towns remain all but inaccessible because roads and bridges have been washed away. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The global fleet of Boeing 737 MAX aircraft remains grounded as the investigation continues into last month's crash of an Ethiopian Airlines jetliner, which killed 157 people on board. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with aviation expert Robert Mann Jr. for more on the implications and the impact the crash has and will have on the bottom line for airlines using this type of plane.
You have a fleet that's been grounded. At some airlines, that's a small percentage of their total fleet. At other airlines, it's a larger percentage. So the effect on any individual airline is more or less proportional to the extent to which that airplane is significant in their fleets. Airlines are usually able to recapture some of the revenue off of canceled flights. Since they're not flying some of these flights, they have some savings associated.
And of course, any revenue that can't be recaptured is a dead loss. How long do you think these Boeing fleets will be grounded?
The situation, if it was merely a technical issue, would be a matter of weeks, not months. And I say that because the technical issue has already been identified, and tragically, it was already identified before the Ethiopian crash, but it had not yet been approved or implemented. But since it's now become a political issue, timeline might be on the order of months.
I thought all this was just a safety issue. Why are politics involved?
In a case where aircraft are being manufactured, the country or the world region in which they are manufactured generally takes the lead in determining the airworthiness of an aircraft. So in the U.S. market, it's the FAA within the Department of Transportation. In Europe, it's something called EASA, E-A-S-A. Typically, the oversight agency that's primary on the aircraft makes that determination and others follow. But what we have in a case with the 737 is that many countries and some airlines chose to act to ground the aircraft before FAA did. China, in particular, was among the lead countries to ground the aircraft, and a number of others followed. So the politics of this issue now become, will any of these countries or carriers outside of the U.S. take FAA's word for it, if you will, that Boeing's proposed fixes are necessary, appropriate, as proposed, and should be implemented as proposed. That injects some uncertainty into whether and how soon the aircraft may be considered airworthiness outside of the U.S.
What about from the air passengers' point of view? Do you think people will feel comfortable flying in these Boeings once the FAA says the fixes have been made?
I don't say this callously, but it's a fact that most customers don't know what kind of aircraft they're flying on. And as a result, you know, they really look for schedule and price as the method of choosing an airline.
Well, then, do you think this accident could result in a worldwide downturn in air travel, no matter the aircraft? That long-term, people may tend just to either stay home near their house or to drive or take a train just for safety purposes?
No, I don't think so. Again, as tragic as any incident is, the rate of such incidents around the world is so vanishingly small. You're actually exposed to far more danger by driving yourself than you are by flying.
Any comment on Ethiopian Airlines and the worldwide perception of Africa as a trustworthy brand or not?
There are a lot of places around the world where I, as a passenger, would choose not to fly on an indigenous airline. I'll be candid about that because I know enough about aviation oversight in some parts of the world that I would just not do it. I won't roll those dice. But that was certainly not the case with Ethiopian, which is a first-rate operator, and I think highly regarded around the world, not just on the continent. These are folks who have done it right for 70 years, grown a really important business, not only for the nation, but for the regional economy. And still, unfortunately, this sort of a tragedy befell an industry leader.
That was aviation expert Robert Mann Jr. speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. This is VOA's International Edition.
Are you looking for a good time this weekend? Hitting the club, house party, or maybe just chilling at home?
It's called Future Baby, Future Maybe.
Well, whichever way you want to roll, I'll get you listening, dancing, and relaxing all in one gorgeous hour.
Good time. Stop with you, good time.
You'll meet artists on the rise like Dawit Sharonet from Addis and Swagger Boys Dynasty from Juba.
Tune in to Music Time in Africa with your host Heather Maxwell on Radio Voice of America.
There's also awesome current hits, traditional music, and classics. So get it all with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. This Sunday, 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Enjoy your weekend.
Legislation aimed at tightening New Zealand's gun laws in response to the deadly mass shootings at two mosques last month passed its first reading in Parliament today. The bill, which passed 119-1, bans military-style semi-automatic rifles and automatic assault rifles, like the weapons used in the March 15th attack on the Al Noor and Linwood Mosque in Christchurch. The attack left 50 worshippers dead. Police Minister Stuart Nash said the massacre revealed that far too many New Zealanders have access to dangerous guns. Conservative lawmaker David Seymour cast the lone dissenting vote and criticized the speed at which lawmakers were moving forward with the legislation. But Seymour missed a chance to stall the legislation when he showed up too late for a procedural vote because he spent too much time talking to reporters about his opposition. While Australia plans to become the first country in the world to impose jail terms and multi-million-dollar fines for social media giants that do not quickly remove violent material. The changes are in response to the live streaming of some of the Christchurch mosque shootings, and a bill will be introduced to the Parliament this week. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Christchurch atrocity was streamed by the gunman live on Facebook for 17 minutes. It remained online for more than an hour after the attack, in which 50 worshippers were murdered at two mosques in the New Zealand city. Australia's Attorney General Christian Porter says the social media giant was too slow to remove the shocking video.
At close to 60 minutes, the New Zealand police requested that they take it down, and that didn't happen until around the 69-minute mark. So what we would say, and I think what any rational person would say, is that that is a totally unreasonable period of time.
The alleged perpetrator is a 28-year-old self-confessed white supremacist from Australia. Australian government ministers met officials from social media companies to discuss the swift removal of offensive content last week, but lawmakers weren't satisfied. Australia now wants to impose multi-billion dollar fines on companies that don't act quickly to take down abhorrent violent material. Executives could go to prison for 3 years. But cybersecurity expert Nigel Fair from the University of New South Wales thinks the proposed legislation goes too far.
I'm a believer that jail time is for serious and violent offenders and not for the marketing executive of a social media company. I think we need to continue the discussion. Fines is a good thing. I'm sure we can get to a balanced way of dealing with this issue.
Facebook says it removed 1.5 million copies of the Christchurch video in the days following the attack. The social media giant has also said it's taking steps to strengthen rules for live streaming and to combat the spread of hate online. Australia's Parliament will consider the new laws this week. The role of social media in the Christchurch massacre will also be scrutinised by a powerful commission of inquiry to be set up by the New Zealand government. The alleged gunman is expected to appear in court on Friday. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A UN watchdog group condemns what it says is Vietnam's repression of basic freedoms and gross violations of human rights, including torture and executions for crimes that breach international law. The UN Human Rights Committee, which monitors the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, has examined the records of 6 countries, including Vietnam, during its latest session. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Human Rights Committee has fulsome praise for Vietnam's economic achievements, but many criticisms regarding its abusive system of governance. It is worried by the dramatic increase in crackdowns against human rights defenders. Committee member Marsha Kran says human rights defenders are harassed, attacked, and held incommunicado in pretrial detention. She says some have received lengthy prison sentences on bogus charges, and some have been ill-treated in custody as well. Another area of concern is the reportedly high number of death sentences and executions in Vietnam. The committee has received reports that 85 people had been executed last year. Crown notes crimes against the state, drug-related crimes, economic and other crimes are punishable by death.
So the situation is that the number and the identities of persons sentenced to death are kept secret by the authorities, which means that it's possible for dissidents to be targeted and sentenced to death without due process. Others have died in custody, and we heard reports that these deaths are then reported by officials as suicide.
The panel of human rights experts is calling for a moratorium on the application of capital punishment or an abolition of the death penalty. The committee finds the Vietnamese government is making progress in passing new legislation. Kran tells VOA a number of laws have been passed that appear to be protective of human rights.
There's a new law on trafficking that prohibits forced labor. There's, in fact, in 2017, there was an amendment to the law on legal aid, so it expanded the list of persons who could access legal aid. There's also amendments to the Penal Code and the Criminal Procedure Code on the right to counsel at all stages of criminal proceedings.
Kran says the legal framework shows some signs of improvement on paper. Unfortunately, she notes, these laws are not being applied in practice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.